Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Now, Ask Dr. Love with psychotherapist, author, love and relationship expert, Dr. Jamie Turndorf. For expert advice on love and relationships, you can submit your questions online at AskDrLove.com or call 1-800-930-2819 during the live broadcast. You can also listen live and download the free show app at TransformationTalkRadio.com. Now here's Dr. Love.
Welcome to Ask Dr. Love. I'm Dr. Jamie Turndorf, and in honor of Valentine's Day, I'm going to share with you the greatest love stories of all the world. And I'm going to tell you a true love story that's never been publicly shared before, my own. And then I'm going to be introducing you to Robert Fulghum, author of the phenomenally best-selling book, All I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. So get cozy and snuggle up, because my own true love story is quite a story. From the time I was a young girl, I had a detailed premonition of the man that I would marry, and so I saw no reason to date. I was content to wait until that man eventually appeared in my life. And he did appear on the first day of my freshman year at Vassar College. Oddly, whenever we took a family road trip, I'd ask my father, "Where are we?" And he always jokingly responded, "Poughkeepsie." Well, destiny was clearly leading me to Poughkeepsie, where I would find my Jean many years later. So back to the first day of my freshman year, I'd been shut out of all the intro sections of sociology, and the secretary told me to see the department chair, Jean Pain. The minute I walked into Jean's office, I felt my soul leave my body as I was transported at high speed through a tunnel to the end of my life. And when I shot back into my body, I received the message, "Remember every aspect of your meeting. He's going to be everything to you one day." I soon forgot this odd premonition and went about my life as a college student. But I later learned that prior to coming to Vassar, Jean had been one of the most famous Jesuit priests in history. A Renaissance man, he held a Doctor of Letters from the Sorbonne, numerous other higher degrees in sociology, classics, religion, law and economics, political science, history, and even philosophy. And his book first captured Pope Paul VI's attention, and the Pope himself called Jean to Rome to teach at the University of the Vatican. Out of the Vatican, he founded the first and only International Social Research Center, and he taught himself 10 languages and then traveled the world conducting face-to-face research to determine if the church was actually meeting the needs of the faithful. And his methods became the standard for all sociological research that followed. And he published in many languages and changed the way the church ministered to the faithful. So Jean also founded the Liberation Theology Movement to fight church oppression from within. And his fight for religious freedom launched him to international fame when he publicly opposed the Catholic Church and Pope Paul VI's attempts to block the legalization of divorce in Italy. And his fight ultimately resulted in the legalization of divorce. As a celebrity priest, he rubbed elbows with aristocrats, kings, movie stars. Audrey Hepburn was his good friend, and the intelligentsia of Rome and Europe. And then each night he would return to his monastery to sleep. Now, he eventually asked the Pope to grant him a dispensation of his vows. And because famous ex-priests are shunned in Europe, he emigrated to the States, where he was recruited by Vassar to chair the Department of Sociology. 3 years after our fated meeting on that first day of my freshman year, I asked if he could help me analyze my data for my senior thesis. And with clicking calculator buttons as mood music, we talked our hearts out. And despite our different cultural backgrounds, generations, and religions, our love ignited like a brush fire. And for nearly 30 years, our love burned brighter with each day. We were completely compatible, twins separated at birth, soulmates. We loved the same activities, music, books, and hobbies. We wrote books together, ran businesses together, restored and decorated houses together, and rejoiced in every moment that we spent together. We were inseparable. Jean always promised to live very old and die with me. Thankfully, he was a very healthy man, but in the last year of his life, we both began having premonitions that he was going to die of an accident. We just didn't know when or where. The day we departed for vacation in Europe, I had a really bad feeling. Lightning struck our rose arbor and destroyed it, and then I saw a flock of 50 or so black crows in our garden. I tried to shrug off the premonitions, but still I couldn't shake the feeling of impending doom. And so we journeyed to Sperlonga, Italy, this whitewashed medieval village built on a rocky outcropping above the Mediterranean Sea. And it rained every day as if the sky were weeping in anticipation of his loss. A few days into the trip, Jean told me that he loved me so much that he would take a bullet for me. His words felt like another omen. When the sky finally cleared, we headed to the beach. And as we were talking, I noticed that his left hand was above his head, as though it were in position to block something. And suddenly, out of nowhere, a bee stung his left palm, just below his index finger, at the exact location of Christ's stigmata. And as soon as he was stung, I said to myself, "He's been struck by a bolt of lightning. He's dead." Jean told me it was so painful and that the venom went very deep. I kissed his palm, my beloved boy, and told him that it would feel better soon. I cupped my hand, I gathered some seawater and sprinkled it on his hand. And early the next morning, around 10 a.m., he awoke and told me that we had to go to the hospital because he was having trouble breathing. I watched as the doctor pierced his adorable little butt as they injected him with what they said was cortisone. Months later, I found out that they didn't administer cortisone, but actually gave him an asthma drug, a gross error. But their discharge summary confirmed no heart attack and normal blood pressure. So we went back to the hotel, elated over his clean bill of health, again rejoicing that he had the body of a young man and he didn't suffer the problems that afflict so many other people. Well, that night it was cold and rainy, so we drove to La Nave restaurant. We dined indoors, holding hands, our eyes melting into each other's, oblivious to the dismal weather. And after the meal, we went back to the hotel. Jean kissed me with such passion, I felt my heart rupture, unable to contain the love. Miraculously, our passion hadn't waned despite the passage of decades. The next day, splinters of rain gave way to hints of sun. I went to the beach, and I napped under a steel-wool sky. And when he found me on the beach, my heart swelled with joy, like lovers reuniting after a long absence. His smile melted my heart. It rained again. We ducked under the overhang near the pool. Serenaded by the patter of raindrops, we kissed. Later in the afternoon, Jean said that despite the injection the hospital had given him during the middle of the night, he could still feel the venom coursing through his veins. And I gave him a massage. He was wearing an angelic smile when I finished. And I asked him why, and he said, "I feel how much you love me." So now it was time to dress for dinner, and I watched my handsome husband adjust his silk tie in the mirror as he completed his toilette. And I still marveled at how handsome he was. How was it possible after 27 years my heart still skittered and my womb stirred whenever I looked at him? We kissed and we walked arm in arm like newlyweds, talking about everything and nothing as we folded ourselves into our tiny Fiat rental car. And I was driving and he pointed me in the direction of Punta Rossa, an elegant restaurant perched high on rouge-colored cliffs. After 45 minutes, we were clearly lost. I parked in front of a pizza dive. He went inside to get directions. After about 10 minutes, he came out looking as white as a sheet, terror written all over his face. I asked, what's wrong? He said, "We have to get back to the hospital. I can't breathe." Clearly, the hospital hadn't given him the right treatment. I could hear him struggling for air. Fluid was rattling in his lungs, like rising like a deluge that threatened to drown him. I sped, mumbling that he had what babies get. "It's like the croup. Don't worry. The hospital will help you." I said, "I love you." He said, "I love you." These were the last words he ever spoke. He didn't have enough air in his lungs to say another word. After about 20 minutes, I screeched into the hospital parking lot, braked with a start, and ran inside. A clot of people were in the waiting room, but no one was at the admitting desk. And I recognized one of the two men who had treated him the day before. "I don't speak Italian, but God help me, I found the words. Mi marito non posso respirare, puntura da ieri. My husband can't breathe, bee sting yesterday." He followed me outside, pushing a wheelchair, moving like an overfed buffalo in a heat wave. He wheeled Jean into the treatment room and put an oxygen mask on his face, but had trouble finding his vein because the vessels were constricted from the venom. Finally, they got it in. As the IV began to drip, they said he'd feel better when the bottle was fully infused. Jean was ripping at the oxygen mask, obviously feeling that it was suffocating him because the air wasn't getting into his lungs. He was covered in sweat. His hair was plastered to his scalp. And I could hear the fluid had reached the very top of his lungs. I was dying watching his agony. I asked them to tilt up the head of the bed, and they did. And after a few minutes, seeing he was no better, I asked if they had a pulmone specialista, a pulmonologist. They didn't answer me, which meant no. Jean obviously needed a tracheotomy. The doctor treating him was an anesthesiologist, and she didn't seem to know how to do this procedure. She beat her hand in the air like an angry librarian scolding a noisy child, telling him to breathe slowly and deeply, thinking he was hyperventilating from panic. And it was obvious that he couldn't breathe slowly or otherwise. Didn't they hear that his lungs were full? He was drowning. He had no air to breathe. So I removed his watch, trying anything in my power to make my beloved boy more comfortable. They brought over a garbage pail and dropped it on the floor in front of him, and I held him from behind as he gagged to expel the thick fluid that had risen to the back of his throat. The IV bottle was empty now, and I asked if he felt better, and he shook his head, and he said no. And I shouted for them to do something, and they came along with a syringe. Adrenalina, they said. As they came at his neck with an enormous needle, they pushed me out of the room and into the waiting room, and the last thing I saw was Jean's eyes rolling up into their sockets as he fell unconscious. I never got to kiss him or say goodbye. In the waiting room, I was hysterical, shaking, panting, begging, using broken Italian and hand gestures for someone to help me get an air ambulance from Rome. And I asked the name of the numero uno ospedale a Roma, the number one hospital in Rome, and I was told Gemelli. But the only way to get transferred there would be for the hospital to call. And they told me, don't bother asking because they won't spend the money to make the call. They added, this isn't a very good hospital. I banged on the door and begged them to call anyway. They dismissed me and said, be patient. I said, he's going to die. He has no air. They pushed me away and locked the door behind me. I tried to use the payphone to call Rome myself, but it was broken. I banged on the door again and asked if I could use the phone in the inner office. They wouldn't let me. And I could hear Jean through the door. I couldn't believe how long he held on with no air, how strong his heart was, how much he fought to live for me. Someone came out once and told me, we're trying to get the fluid out of his lungs. And another time a doctor came out and asked me if he was taking any medications. He wasn't. There wasn't a thing wrong with him. And after what seemed an eternity, a man came into the waiting room wearing a downtrodden expression. He told me in Italian that they were sorry. I collapsed in a woman's arms. The crowd barraged me with questions. Was I alone in Italy? Do you have children? Where was I staying? Someone from the medical staff came out again. I said I wanted Jean's rings and clothing. He said Italian law requires that I be present when they remove them from his body. He said, come, it's fine. I tentatively followed him like a child afraid of my first dental visit. I followed him down a corridor and entered the room where Jean was laid out on a gurney. His face was red as a lobster, his mouth wide open, his body stiff as a board. I ran out screaming. They tried to give me a liquid to drink, but I wouldn't swallow it, afraid they were going to kill me, too. I left our rental car in the parking lot, and Bruno from the hotel drove me back. I was sure that I'd never succeed in scrubbing his image from my mind, never stop hearing the rattling sound of his suffocating to death. And I vaguely recall holding John's clothing minus his pants and thinking, in death a person soils himself, and I felt embarrassed and an outrage on his behalf that such an elegant man should have been forced to suffer such indignity. Back into the hotel room, I fell on the bed. The sound of his suffocating droned in my head like an endless stutter. Etched on my brain was the image of my sweet love's beautiful face turned scarlet. The pain in my heart seared my chest. My ears felt like they would rupture from the sound of my pounding heart, and I was sure I was dying of a heart attack. I collapsed on my side of the bed, crying and trembling in terror. Suddenly, I felt a gentle caress that extended the length of my spine. I glanced over my shoulder. Nothing and no one was there. This was just the beginning of Jean's visitations. He's been with me ever since. And thanks to Jean's ongoing visits, I discover again and again that relationships don't end in death and that love never dies. I just want you to know before I take a brief break, you don't have to be allergic to die of a bee sting. Bee venom causes pulmonary pressure and tension, which causes the lungs to gradually fill with fluid. I learned this the hard way. And eventually you drown and the heart stops. And antihistamines prevent this fatal cascade. All right, let me take a brief break, and I'll be back with you in a moment on Ask Dr. Love.
dream is to end homelessness.
My passion is living a green life.
My dream is to end poverty.
My passion is volunteering.
My passion is making a difference.
My dream is to cure Lyme disease.
My passion is rebuilding communities.
My passion is helping those in need.
My passion is caring for the elderly.
My dream is to find a cure for cancer.
My dream is to leave a better world for my children.
We all have that special passion, that lifelong dream that drives us to live our lives with meaning and to create a better world. No matter what drives you, we can all make an impact. Dr. Pat Basile is helping others make their dreams come true, so we can all help make our world a better world.
To learn more about how Dr. Pat is building a community of sharing hope, strength, funds, knowledge, and information, visit abetterworldcrowdfunding.com today. That's abetterworldcrowdfunding.com.
Tired of traditional talk? People pontificating about this or that, the left or the right. Sometimes the truth is just all lost in the noise. Tune in each week to Straight Talk with Chuck Gallagher on TransformationTalkRadio.com, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, as nationally known guests talk about what's important to you, your life, your concerns, and your success. Tune in and turn on to Straight Talk with Chuck Gallagher. Visit ChuckGallagher.com for more information.
You're listening to Ask Dr. Love with Dr. Jamie Turndorf. AskDrLove.com is the web's premier relationship advice site since 1995. Visit AskDrLove.com to search thousands of Dr. Love's relationship advice columns or submit a question to her free advice column. Don't be shy. Dr. Turndorf wants to help you, so take advantage of this unique opportunity to get a personal answer from one of today's most respected experts. This show is for you, the listener, so if you have a question for her, call in during the live show broadcast or catch the archive show on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Now, back to Dr. Love.
Now back to Ask Dr. Love with Jamie Turndorf, Ph.D. Once again, here's Dr. Love.
This is the time in the show for my new segment that I'm calling Dr. Love's Quickie because, as you know, it's a short and sweet spot, only 6 minutes. Now, before the break, I told you about my remarkable love story with Jean, and I promised in my newsletter to spell out the unusual practice that kept our love so strong. But before I do, I want to backtrack for a second and say that most couples that come to me for help are trapped in what I call scorekeeping. You know you're scorekeeping if you keep a running mental tally of all the ways in which you are feeling deprived or cheated by your partner. And you'll hear yourself saying something like, well, you know, I did this 3 times last week and he only did it once. Okay. When you feel deprived, the natural tendency is to punish the other person and give less. And guess what? You fall into a vicious cycle in which you're both more like baby birds with your beaks open waiting for the other person to drop a worm on you. And in this environment of passivity, you are starving rather than nourishing each other. And this practice leads to marital and relationship distress. Now, what Sean and I did was the opposite of scorekeeping. He devoted himself to meeting my needs to the best of his ability, and so did I. And the beauty of this practice is that both partners get fed simultaneously. And when both partners are devoted to feeding each other, nobody goes hungry. So I asked him once, how can you give me so much? And he said, I just love you, Jamie. And truly, love is an endless well. When you tap into the source of love, your well never runs dry. And love also nudges you to improve yourself and your ability to be a better and better partner. You know, whenever he said or did something to upset me, he'd tell me, I promised Jamie for as long as I live to work on changing that aspect of myself. And he did keep his word. Every day of his life was a quest for perfection. He was like an innocent child, an open book, seeking to know more, to learn more, to grow more, all with the intention of being a better and more loving husband, as if that were possible. And right before our final trip, when I was doing a juice fast and I needed a special organic ingredient only found in a faraway health food store, he drove an hour each way after a long day of work to get the item for me. And when I thanked him, he said, I love to be able to help you. Jean's capacity for love wasn't of this earth. He was and is an endless well of giving. And for all of our 27 years together, even up until the last week, he'd call me each Wednesday morning and say, "Is Jamie there?" And I'd say, "Yes." And he'd say, "Are you free for a date? I hope that I called you early enough and that another guy hasn't asked you out already." And when I returned from Italy alone without him, I was so broken. And then I opened the folder that he had labeled "in case," and I read his last line, which said, "I'm not here anymore, but wherever I am, I'll always watch over you and love you immensely. My dear Jean, I will always love you. You are my north, my south, my east, and my west." Now, what if, inspired by our love, you made the resolution to drop the scorecard and just give without strings? This is when the magic occurs. When you transform your heart into that well that overflows, love flows back to you with abundance. And there's more. The love you share in this life sets the stage for an ongoing love relationship. True love doesn't have a happy ending because true love doesn't end. Relationships do not end in death. Love never dies. And I don't mean that love only lives on in my memories. I mean the relationships with those that we love in spirit can and do continue. And it is the strength of the love that Jean and I shared that allows him to pierce the thin veil that divides this realm and the next. And to this day, he still comes through to me, often in front of witnesses, manifesting his presence and showering me in eternal love. So you give without expectation, without a scorecard, and you too will transform your marriage or relationship into an endless well of love that lasts a lifetime and beyond. So let me just give you a couple of tweets before I take a break. The greatest love stories have much to teach about stretching your love muscles beyond their normal reach. And if our hearts remained as pure as a kid's, our love lives wouldn't end up on the skids. Let our love story serve as a potion that sets your love in motion. Love stories can be an aphrodisiac that gets your own love back on track. And love stories that are inspirational can help make your own love more sensational. And last but not least, hearing others' love stories inspires you to revel in love's ultimate glories. All righty, I'm going to take a brief break. And then, when I return, I am going to introduce you to my wonderful guest, Robert Foljam. Be back in a moment on Ask Dr. Love Radio.
Your lifestyle in retirement? It's a question people often wonder about. Ask Ameriprise financial advisor Jeff Packman about the new Confident Retirement approach. You and Jeff can break down retirement planning step by step to get the real answers you need. In fact, 93% of clients who have had the Confident Retirement approach conversation feel more confident about their retirement. Call Jeff Packman, financial advisor, at 425-453-0272 for your Confident Retirement conversation today. Office is located at 601 108th Avenue Northeast, Suite 1800, Bellevue, Washington, 98004. Percentage based on Ameriprise Financial Confident Retirement Client Survey as of December 2013. The Confident Retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment and advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, member of FINRA and SIPC.
Would you like to be a question with anything that comes up in your body or mind? Would you like to become totally aware and begin to function as the conscious being you truly are? Join Access Certified Facilitator Glenna Rice every month for a live teleclass where you can ask all of your questions and learn to create change in any aspect of your life. Visit GlennaRice.com today to learn more and don't miss the next call. Join the questionable conversation today at GlennaRice.com.
Tune in each Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 Eastern Time on Transformation Talk Radio to Limelight Radio with Katina Macris. This is an inspirational, cutting-edge radio show educating worldwide listeners on a diversity of Lyme disease-related topics. Each week, Katina will interview some of the world's leaders in health, wellness, spirituality, and human potential. For more information, visit LimeLightRadio.com.
You're listening to Ask Dr. Love with Dr. Jamie Turndorf. If you've yearned to get along better with your life partner or spouse, friends, family members, and even coworkers, Dr. Turndorf's Hay House book, Kiss Your Fights Goodbye, Dr. Love's 10 Simple Steps to Cooling Conflict and Rekindling Your Relationship, shows you how to turn conflict into connection for a lifetime of lasting love. Find out more about this book at AskDrLove.com. This is Ask Dr. Love with Dr. Jamie Turndorf. This show is for you, the listener, and Dr. Love wants to hear from you. You can submit your questions at AskDrLove.com, or if you're listening in real time, you can speak to Dr. Turndorf live by calling 800-930-2819. To listen live and download the free show app, go to TransformationTalkRadio.com. All shows are archived at TransformationTalkRadio.com. You're listening to Ask Dr. Love with Dr. Jamie Turndorf. Once again, here's Dr. Love.
You're listening to Ask Dr. Love with Jamie Turndorf, Ph.D. Once again, here's Dr. Love.
I'm Dr. Jamie Turndorf, and I'm so happy now to be introducing you to Robert Fulghum, the author of the phenomenally best-selling book, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. So, I want to welcome you to my show. Robert, are you here?
I am here, and good morning. I must say before we go any further that following your own amazing love story is going to be an uphill work. That's a beautiful story. Thanks for sharing it.
I'm so glad. I was so touched that you so early to the show so that you could hear the whole story, and that really meant a lot to me.
Well, I'm glad I didn't miss it, and it truly is a remarkable story.
So talk to me about the re-release of your kindergarten book.
Well, this book is now in its 25th year, and there's a 25th anniversary edition of it that's just come out. It's been revised and updated, and there are 25 new stories. And then later in the year, there will be a book called All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, the sequel, which is another collection of stories that are similar to the ones in the first book. So this is a big year for that book. It's amazing that it's remained in print and alive for all these years.
Why do you think that is? What do you especially?
Well, I often say I'm not a great writer, but what I do write about is what a great many people are greatly concerned and involved in. And I guess I have the capacity to say out loud what a lot of people think and feel. And I tend to look at the most ordinary aspects of life and think, you know, what's the deep part of this? And the kindergarten essay, which is, you know, has a life of its own now, people often think, oh, that's cute and that's sweet. But in fact, it's about the truth that we are introduced very early on to important things in life. And we are given them in the language of children. But as we grow up, we realize they're about the important things. So I'm glad that book lasts. Who knows where it'll go? But that is, I'm holding one in my hand. I just got it from the publisher. And then the sequel will come out. At the same time, there'll also be two other books, one on tango dancing and one on my experiences of learning the tango dance. But that's a story for another time.
Oh.
I'll tell you a little bit about that at the end of the show.
You know, I was thinking that tango really is a metaphor for life and love, isn't it?
Yes, it's scary and it's passionate and all those good things, but let's hold that till the end because that's how I want to finish what we do.
Your book is going to be titled the re-released version of the kindergarten book. Is it going to be called What I Know Now?
Well, no, the actual volume is still called All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten and has a big sticker on the front that says 25th Anniversary Edition. And then there is a second book that has the same title except the big red letters that say the sequel. So that'll be out in the fall.
Okay. So that book, how do you get an inspiration for a book like that? Does it just hit you as my book ideas come as a sort of a channeled wind that shoots through me? How did you get the idea?
Well, I have all my life been writing stories, and it's just what I do. And I look at the world in a very careful way as I go about in it. And I can't not write. It's like someone who's a professional painter or something. That's who you are. That's how you resolve your relationship with the world. So I have more. I'm still writing a blog, as people call it now, but it's a daily journal that robertfulgham.com, and I always have a lot more material to write about because there's so much in the world to see and talk about. So I keep writing.
So even when what I found is when Jean died, I had to write. That was how I dealt with the experience of losing him in bodily form.
Yes.
The only way that I could process it, not so much speaking out loud, but writing.
Yes. No, that's the story. That's my case.
So it's a very, very solitary process. So, you know, I also noticed when I was on your website, you had a book called True Love, which was reader-submitted stories about their own love stories. Are there any of those stories that stick in your mind now that we're, you know, in Valentine's week?
Well, let me give you a little background on that. I had a wonderful experience. I decided that I would ask people, as I often had, for them to tell me a love story. So I went around, only in Seattle, and I set up a small table with a sign on it that said, tell me a love story and I'll make you famous. And people came over and sat down, and pretty soon I'd collect a group of people, and then people would tell their love stories. And I'd set up in front of coffee houses and a couple of bars and a tavern, and ended up with far more material than I can ever use. Because people would tell their love story, and then they would say, well, that's nothing, let me tell you mine. And one of the reasons people were so involved in this is because the book that I was planning to do was going to, all the royalties were going to go to Habitat for Humanity, and you know, quite a lot of money ended up in their lap. So people were doing good by sharing their love stories. And I guess about 1,000 stories came after the book came out. People then wrote in and sent me their love stories. The book is called True Love because that's what it is, but my original title for it was Love is a Bitch and It Has Puppies, but the publisher wasn't happy with that. But it talked about the fact that, you know, there's all kinds of sides of love. There's the good side and then there's the hard side. So that book is still in print, can still be gotten. Amazon has it. And if I wanted everyone to do another book of true love stories, I have more than enough.
My version would be Lay Down and Play Dead.
Yes, indeed. But I realized when you and I had our earlier conversation about being on the show that I had written a lot about love over the years, and so I went comb through and came up with some short things that are what I know and understand about love, which I'd be glad to share with you if you'd like.
These are the 10 best things you've said about love. I'd love to hear that.
Well, you have to understand that my position on this is that anything anybody says or thinks about love anytime is true for them at the moment, is worthy of respect at the moment, and is always subject to change. And it's a catch-all word, but we're really celebrating love between men and women, or men and women these days. It's not about Valentine's Day. It's not about sending a card to your dog. It's about giving something else. But I thought you might be interested in these statements, which I pulled out. One, love is not all wine and roses and walks on the beach. Love includes pain. Love causes pain, cures pain, and is often a pain. Another one is, we're all a little weird, and life is weird. And when we find someone whose weirdness is compatible with ours, we join into mutually satisfying weirdness, and then we call it love. Another is, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. Another is, the game of love is never called on account of darkness or rain. Another is, most of us need love the most when we're the most unlovable. Another is, if you concentrate on giving love, your task will seem small, but the rewards will be large. If you concentrate on getting love, your task will seem large, and the results are small. Another one is, anyone who says they fully understand love is either lying, stupid, or dead. And I always say to people, don't fall in love with love, fall in love with people and take the consequences. As long as you live, be somebody's Valentine. And then the final one is, I think it's a profound thought, one I've read in a lot of other places. In my words, you can only get from another person the love they are able and willing to give, and the form they can give it in. get from another person the love you demand and need in the form you wish. If you don't understand that, you'll never be happy in love.
Ain't that the truth? I remember one time when I was having a dispute with my husband, and he said in his French accent, "But Jamie, I'm doing all what I can."
Yes, yes. You take what you can get, not what you demand, and love will work out. You know, I had an interesting experience, which I think might fits into what we're talking about. I was a Unitarian parish minister for 20 years, and when I was very young. And when I first went to the church, I was 24. Most of the people in the church were a lot older than I, but because I held the position of minister, I started, and I was the first minister the church had had, so I got an awful lot of visits in my office from couples who wanted marriage counseling. And my image of marriage became very sour and very negative because people come to a minister with troubles. So I said to my congregation, both in the church newsletter and also from the pulpit, that I was finding my attitudes toward marriage were getting pretty negative, and I would love to be able to talk to people who would never come and talk to me, which is people who had a strong marriage or a strong love relationship, and it had to be longer than 7 years, and they could either self-nominate themselves or someone tell me about them, and I'll get in touch with them. So over about a year and a half, I ended up with evening sessions in their home of 30 couples who could simply say, yes, we have a happy love relationship. Some of them been married like 8 years, I think was the youngest, and then one couple had been married 56 years. And they all said in substance the same thing about why their love had lasted and grown. And the first thing they said in one way or another was, this person is my best friend. I could not, I get teary when I think about this because it was so clear, and it was the first thing they said. I never had a better friend than this. I never hoped to. The second thing they said, which I found true in my own life, is that we laugh a lot. We see a lot of humor in our own foibles in the world and are very clear between what's an inconvenience and what's a real problem. And the final thing that they said in different ways, and you've already said it in your program this morning, is that we don't keep score, we don't collect garbage, we put garbage where it belongs. And most of them said, we don't go to bed if we're mad at each other or have had a fight without settling. And those three things were consistent in the 30 couples that I talked to. So I ended up with a much better notion about what was possible in marriage. And I continue, when I ask people at cocktail parties when I get really bored, I will say to people, tell me a love story, or how long have you been married, and if you've been married a long time, tell me what has made it last. And I get those same answers over and over. Don't collect garbage or keep score, laugh a lot, and know that this is your best friend.
You know, I used to say to Jean, and he considered this quite a compliment, Robert, I would say, Jean, you're my best girlfriend with a penis.
That's
so true. And we would laugh so much that he would weep, literally weep from tears, because I have a crazy, raunchy, wild sense of humor. And this former famous, former Jesuit, I would get him on the floor crying. We would laugh so hard.
Yes.
And you have to have those two elements. And yes, not keeping score, because when you truly love, you don't keep score. You just give with all of your heart, and you don't worry about whether you're going to get it back. And then paradoxically, you do when you don't score.
Yeah, no, that's true. If you don't worry about what you're getting and only about what you're giving, then it'll all work out.
Absolutely. So tell me this. You said that you wanted me to ask you about the short version of what you essentially believe. What is that?
Well, I'm always trying to get this smaller, and this is something I've put in several of my books, and it only has six lines. I believe that imagination is stronger than knowledge. I believe that myth is more potent than history. I believe that dreams are more powerful than facts. I believe that hope always triumphs over experience. I believe that laughter is the only cure for grief. And I believe that love is stronger than death. That's it.
Do you hear how much what you're saying echoes my own experience?
Yes, that's why I wanted to use it. I read a lot of things you'd written, and I thought, oh, she'll get this.
My goodness, I am so blessed that I found you, because we truly, truly are speaking the same language. And I heard your voice catch when you spoke about love being stronger than death. So I am sensing that someone you have loved very deeply is now in spirit form. Is that true?
Well, no. Actually, I've thought about someone I love deeply that I wish was dead, but she's long gone. So that's a whole other story for another time. I was in a divorce settlement from a wife I had been married to for 30 years and who was very unhappy and finally went away. And she brought all the spreadsheets and her lawyer and all that. And all my only contribution to the whole thing, because I had sought marriage counseling, divorce counseling from Faye the Tattooed Psychic, which cost me $300, which was a pretty cheap divorce. And so I wrote the poem, and that's all I had was a poem to offer her for all the legal stuff. And the end of it was that I wish you were dead. I hope the people who know you would be happier when you were. It was a terrible thing to do. But yeah, you know, that's what I said earlier, that the other side of love is not is indifference. When you hate somebody, it's because you still love them, and you have a hard time putting that down.
Hate is the flip side of love, because you can't work up that kind of anger towards someone you don't love. Let me take a brief break, Robert, and I'll be back with all of you in a moment on Ask Dr. Love Radio.
Are you tired of being tired? Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack. Did you know the adrenal glands, the workhorse of the body? They are the means by which you position yourself in life for whatever comes your way. Tiny but mighty, producing hormones the body uses to promote energy and vitality. These adrenals determine how you respond to stress, and when depleted, the body loses its ability to function powerfully when we need it most. The much-needed adrenaline or epinephrine is not available for emergency situations. Cortisone and cortisol, the longer-acting anti-stress adrenal hormones, can also become depleted due to the pace of our everyday lives. We overwork and undernutrition our most powerful ally that helps us to live the lives we desire. We are able to determine the optimum function of the adrenals and put your system back in balance. Contact us today to feel powerfully energized at 888-777-4232 or visit us at MaryJaneMack.com.
Artie Hoffman is the hottest psychic with the warmest heart and the host of the hit show Angels and Answers. A renowned psychic, medium, spiritual life coach, and an entertaining motivational speaker, Artie has helped over 15,000 people with his amazing intuitive gifts, his passion, and his humor. Call 877-ANGEL-02 to schedule a personal reading or to have your own psychic Artie party. That's 877-ANGEL-02. And visit ArtieHoffman.com and Angels and Answers on Facebook.
Called the Oprah of Radio by her listeners. Award-winning host Dr. Pat Basile is blowing the doors off of traditional talk radio. Get ready for an energizing delivery and powerful interviews with leaders in the field of human potential. Dr. Pat's fresh, new perspective on living life full out has catapulted her show to the top of talk radio. Tune in and Dr. Pat will help you thrive instead of merely survive. Visit thedrpatshow.com. That's thedrpatshow.com for listening times in your area.
You're listening to Ask Dr. Love with Dr. Jamie Turndorf. If you or someone you know has lost a loved one, Dr. Turndorf's best-selling Hay House book, Love Never Dies, How to Reconnect and Make Peace with the Deceased, presents her groundbreaking new transdimensional grief therapy method, which offers the first vehicle in history for reconnecting and making peace with the deceased. Sign up for Dr. Love's free newsletter at AskDrLove.com and receive an exciting gift. A free excerpt of Love Never Dies. Now, back to Dr. Love.
You're listening to Ask Dr. Love with Jamie Turndorf, PhD. Once again, here's Dr. Love.
And I'm here with my special guest, Robert Fulghum, author of the phenomenally best-selling book, All I Really Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten, and we're sharing love stories. And, Robert, I wanted to have you tell me about your own love story.
Well, as a background to this, I should say that when I was doing the love story book, an overwhelming number of people whose stories were told to me or who were sent in to me had to do with love later in life when people knew a lot about love, having either gotten divorced or having had a death or a love that never got consummated, but a number of people would talk about going back to their high school or their college reunion to look for the love that they still had in their mind from way back then. As you probably well know, it seldom worked out, but sometimes it did. But I had, in my own life, I'd been separated and alone and then divorced for about 10 years and had reached the age of 70. And I got to thinking about this, how many people who essentially felt that if they'd gotten that far in life, that they probably would not find love again, even though they looked for it, or it would be superficial or shallow, or something was really lost that they would never get. And they essentially were through. They were sitting in the waiting room of the bus that takes you away sooner or later. And I thought, I am not going to do this. So I thought, I looked at my own bucket list of things that I thought I would always like to do. And one of them was learning to dance tango. And when I said something to my oldest son, he said, "Tango? You? At your age?" And I said, "No, that's the whole point. I don't want to be me at my age. I want to be, I want to look like John Travolta did in his great movie where he was doing the flashy thing on the dance floor." I can't remember the movie at the time. But anyhow, I thought, what the heck? So I started learning to tango and found that I could do it. And then I went to Argentina to intensive tango school for about 4 months and found that I was competent at tango dancing, but on the other hand, there wasn't anybody I really wanted to tango dance with. But I came back to the States, and one of the things I learned that a man who is well-dressed, which I like to be, and who can dance tango, and who understands that the purpose of being a good male tango dancer is to make the woman you dance with look good and feel good. Without flashiness, she just needs to walk away and think, "Well, I had a dance." So I started deep involvement in the tango community, met a young woman who I thought was quite remarkably attractive, and a lot of other men did too, and who was a very successful painter and very beautiful and quite a remarkably good tango dancer. And it never occurred to me that she would have any interest in me because there was a significant age difference.
How much? Come on.
And I'm 76. She's turning 34 this week. And so she called me and said, "I'd like to fix you dinner." And I thought, I wonder what she wants. And so at that conversation, I said, "I'm going to Bali for Christmas for a couple of months. You ever been to Bali? No. Would you like to go to Bali?" "Yes." I thought she was pulling my leg. Well, I know now, because she's my wife, that she had decided that, never mind our age difference, that I was the kind of guy that she's like you and your husband. And there was a connection. And everybody brings baggage to a relationship. You've got dogs or children or ill relatives or debts or failure or whatever. But the only baggage in our case was a significant age difference. But it didn't make a difference to us. And it's, it's other people's problem, not ours. So, sure enough, she went to Bali with me for 3 months. And we made a deep connection, and we've been married now for 3 years, got married in Greece in the island of Crete, and I've never been happier in my life. And I am so glad that at 70 I didn't say, "Well, it's over and I will not find love again." And you always think about what you're looking for. It never occurs to you that someone might be looking for you. I've never ever spent any time with a psychic in my life, but when I was in Argentina writing a novel, I went to see a psychic of the possibility of one of the characters who would be doing this, and the lady there said, "Oh, no, I can't do this for fictional people, but I'll tell you that the love of your life is waiting for you, and it's someone you know." So I went home and made a long list of everybody I could think of, and it was a pretty shabby list, I must say. And I didn't realize until I got back to the States that I was on her list.
Absolutely, Mark. Do you realize how similar our stories are? Because you were a theology major and a parish minister, and Jean was a Jesuit priest, and I was the first love of his life, and we had a huge age difference. I thought we had just absolutely broken the record on age difference, but you beat me. So how do you like
Well, Well, I was really struck and actually in tears when you were telling your story, because I realized that yours is very much like mine. It's there's not a problem with the age difference if you are connected. And if you're not connected, the age is not going to help one way or the other.
When I was with my psychoanalyst, when I first fell in love with Jean, I was here in my early 20s, and she said to me in a scolding voice, "This is a very incestuous choice," implying he was like a father figure to me. And I said without missing a beat, "You're right, it is very incestuous. I know I'm his mother."
Well, you know, we say that, and in fact, there's a profound truth in that, that any relationship that works and lasts for a long time, you have these shifting roles that are essentially called, without any other name, they're called the nurturing aspects of relationship. There are times when I'm clearly the needy child in our relationship, because I'm still the child I've always been somewhere in there. And there are other times when I am her parent because she needs the experience and solidarity that I have. But it's not the same role all the time. It shifts from day to day. And then there are a lot of times we're just two adults doing what we do together. But to miss the opportunity of playing that nurturing role is to miss an essential part of long-lasting love, I think.
Absolutely. You have to be willing and capable of flowing into all the roles. And in spite of our 37 and a half year age difference, he was my little boy so yep. often. And that's just part of it. And we consciously used our relationship, which is actually what I talk about in my books. You use the relationship to consciously help each other heal the wounded parts of the child that still live inside you.
Sure, or in my case, I have a really wild and crazy and foolish child, and my wife, who never wanted to have children, when some of the people say to us, "Well, don't you want to have a child?" And she says, "I've got one, and that's enough." But the capacity to be in her company and feel free to cry or to laugh or be silly or foolish is a great blessing to me. And the other way around, in her situation, when she gets very anxious about her painting and her gallery shows and stuff, then I'm there as a solid brick for her. And I don't put the label father figure on that. I simply say I am the mature adult in the situation who can nurture and comfort her in her need. And the terminology is not nearly as important as the role that you're playing and willing to play in a free and open way.
Absolutely. I'm so incredibly moved that we found each other and that I'm able to share my experience with you and you with me, because our marriages were very and are very similar, very similar. And it's a striking thing, because I've never met anybody who is describing really the mirror image of my experience.
Maybe we should have a date.
You would be my Valentine, you know, my radio Valentine anyway, because I think you already are. And I think it is extraordinary that I found you. And if you think about it, the way I came across, you know, the notion of having you on my show, I just asked my husband, "Send me the right person for me to share our love story with." And you just popped onto my computer at that moment.
Oh, that's amazing. That's truly amazing. You know, one of the things I listened to recently was a program on the NPR talking about the wider understanding of love that we've got going on in the culture, that we're openly saying, A, that the government ought to stay out of anybody's love life, and two consenting adults are free to love each other however they may. And it's the personal dimensions of that don't deserve the labels, but we have gotten to the point where, in my home state of Washington, where same-sex marriage is acceptable and legal, and I know a lot of gay and lesbian couples who have adopted children and have a wonderful family life. And I'm really glad that our society is getting to that level of where whatever works for people is what we're in favor of. And I listened to a program the other day. It was talking about a man who has, I forget his name now, but who started an international organization for people who are asexual, in the sense that sexuality is just not high priority for them, but love still is, and the intimacy still is, and caring still is. And so the broader that we get in our understanding about people's need for one another, is an important understanding to come to. I think it makes for a healthier society. And then I heard a program, a guy, it was a scientist, and he was just saying, well, this thing called love is just a matter of craving in the brain, in the ventral tegmental area where dopamine is produced, and then dopamine is mixed with testosterone, and then you get an oxytocin level rising and all this sort of stuff. I thought, no, because it's just love.
You introduce love to the chemical cocktail, you need to take drugs.
Yes.
Really? So how are you and Willow going to spend Valentine's Day?
Well, we were in Tucson recently to take our paintings down for a show, and I found a Mexican place that makes piñatas, and so I had a big Mexican-style piñata made in a heart shape, and then bought 10 pounds of Mexican street candy, which is one of my childhood favorites. There's less of that now. I don't know whether we're going to make it to have Valentine's Day with the candy, but we're going to have a piñata party and whack a heart around and laugh and have a good time. And that's on, and invite friends in to do this. And one of the couples is gay, another couple is just confused. We have a wide variety of people coming, but that's what we'll do.
Whack the piñata, but not each other, and you're just going to never grow up, which keeps you eternally young. And I want to thank you so much because you have really brought me such a special Valentine's gift. Being with you and knowing you, I feel like we've just begun a very special new friendship.
Well, invite me back on your program sometime. I'd be glad to be there.
I want you to be back, and thank you so much again. Is there anything you want to leave my listeners with? Any parting thought? Anything?
Well, I think one of the last things that I had on my list of important thinking about love is to advise people to always try to be somebody's Valentine. Whatever we think about these formal holidays, which in fact this is not a government-sponsored official deal, this is something that comes out of our own cultural need. And whatever you think about Valentine, at least here's a culturally appropriate, permissive moment that says celebrate love and be with someone you love in any way for Valentine's. Never mind all the silly, craziness, commercial aspects of it. Love is not something to leave out of your life.
Absolutely, every day, treat every day like Valentine's Day. And I am so happy to have made you my new Valentine. And I am going to be having you back very soon and often. So happy Valentine's Day to you and Willow. And I'll be speaking to you. And that's all I have for you this week on Ask Dr. Love Radio. It was a wonderful show. I enjoyed being with you all. Remember, make every day Valentine's Day. See you next week on Ask Dr. Love Radio.
This has been Ask Dr. Love with Dr. Jamie Turndorf. Visit Dr. Turndorf at AskDrLove.com and follow her on Twitter at AskDrLove and Facebook.com/AskDrLove.
Hi, I'm Leslie Fontaine with Sheer Alchemy on Transformation Talk Radio, and here's your tip for the day. What is abundance? It isn't the same to all of us. So what's your personal gold? Is it the full expression of yourself in business, or in love, or in the creation of a book or product, or the service you offer? All of the above? When we step into allowing our joy that corresponds with our essence, we are literally coming out of the closet and making new choices. We look and sound different. We don't even talk about the same things anymore. We have a new spark. So wouldn't it make sense that it causes ripples and earthquakes around us? When you shift, you affect everyone around you. You're teaching people to step into all that they are, and they will come to you and say, what have you done? What makes you different? Join me on Sheer Alchemy on Transformation Talk Radio, and let's go deep with your abundance.
On the cutting edge of the new mainstream, Christine Upchurch is passionate about bringing together science, psychology, and spirituality in a way that can be applied to our everyday lives for true transformation. The Christine Upchurch Show. Stellar conversations to illuminate your journey. Engages some of the most outstanding visionaries on the planet in lively dialogue to inspire you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Join Christine every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KKNW, AM 1150, and Transformation Talk Radio.